When the pandemic hit and swept across the U.S., the first person I thought of as Tiger King rose to popularity was my friend Sharon Guineup. We met in an unusual place, self-defense class at National Geographic Explorers Festival. We were both learning Krav Maga together as a way of keeping safe in the field. It was my first hour on campus, and I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But Sharon kept me calm and told me about some of her wild adventures as an investigative reporter. I've been holding on to this conversation for 1 year because she is so inspiring. I've been fueled this year by Sharon's relentless spirit and stories. I hope that her stories inspire you the same way they inspire me. Please sit back and enjoy.
I'm Peg Kiner, and this is Thriving on the Possibility. In this season, we'll explore episodes of female explorers explaining the stories of resilience. Shame researcher Brené Brown says that there are few words that people tell themselves to overcome obstacles, that they say, "This is the story I'm telling myself," and that through that narrative, they can overcome struggles and achieve greatness. I'm on the hunt for that story. So, here at National Geographic, I found female explorers to come tell me their stories of resilience, of how they've navigated obstacles, overcome struggles, and all those small steps that they take each day to keep going.
Hi, this is Thriving on the Possibility, and I'm your host, Peg Kiner. I have the esteemed privilege to be in session today with Sharon Guineup. Sharon, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Where are you recording from today?
I'm spending a few weeks up in the Catskill Mountains in New York.
Wonderful. I'm glad you get some rest and time away, maybe time with family.
Absolutely. And a lot of it was strictly fleeing urban infection from COVID. Where I live is very densely populated, and we had, you know, very high early spikes in the New York metropolitan area where I live, you know, early on. So it's been really wonderful to be in nature.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to join us today. Now, listeners, Sharon is someone I look up to so much, and you have to know ahead of time that Sharon is someone I met in self-defense class at National Geographic Explorers Fest. And ever since that first day, she has been someone that I look to as a pillar of strength and determination. She's an environmental journalist, but also so much more. So thank you, Sharon. I'm so excited to talk to you today, and I would love for you to just share with us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
That's a pretty broad question. I'm an investigative journalist. I do public speaking. But I didn't start that way. I started as a photographer. I've been in journalism in one way or another, you know, my entire career. I initially started photographing people and culture, traveled widely, and then mid-career, I went to graduate school and studied both science and journalism and became a writer, and then slowly migrated into investigative work. So it's been a fun journey. I love my work.
It is a journey, and you've gone through so many different kind of phases of storytelling. Can you tell us a little bit more about what brought you to photography?
Well, it started really early. When I was about 5 years old, my grandfather gave me an Instamatic camera and used to give me film and get it processed for me. When I was seven, he gave me a suitcase and a typewriter, and he told me I was going to need that when I went to college. He's the only person that ever mentioned college to me. And then when I was 16, I was a high school dropout. And right after I dropped out of high school, someone gave me a 35 millimeter camera. And I had a camera on my shoulder every day of my life until I was about 33. So, you know, I started traveling widely. I spent 4 months in Mexico when I was 17. I think that's where I made my first real images. And I spent a lot of time in Turkey. I lived there for a year in my late 20s, photographing on a Fulbright. So I was a documentary photographer. And again, it was people and culture that I was then interested in. But slowly, I shot some stories that involved science and wildlife. And that was always, you know, at the core of who I was. Again, as a child, I spent a lot of time in the garden with my grandfather, an avid gardener, and he was also a bird lover. We put out melon seeds for the cardinals. To this day, I see a cardinal, I think of my grandfather. So he taught me to love nature and to value travel and education and photography. So much of who I am was, you know, came from my grandfather, whose name was Bill McKenzie. So, you know, again, it's been quite a journey, but subject matter really changed when I migrated from a career in photography to, you know, a career, you know, as a writer. It always has been storytelling in one way or another. And I think my early work has really informed my later work because I'm really interested in broad storytelling. If you're going to tell the story of an animal, for example, you need to, you know, look into the natural history. You need to look into the threats that face the animal, the people that live alongside it, and the conservation efforts that are trying to save it. So I really like including broad context in my work. And again, that's just been part of the whole journey.
You're giving us a big, broad context of yourself right now, too, as you talk about it's this microcosm of your work, but also we're seeing this big picture of you and what led you on this journey. And it sounds like your grandfather and the people that you met along the way were really influential in kind of guiding your lens of how you see the world and what you invest your time and attention to. So it sounds like your grandfather really ignited this spark photography and the love of nature that you carry with you today. I'm really curious about this travel that you went on. You told us you were a high school dropout, but that a camera really gave you this access. And I think there's a lot of kids and just people who feel that same access when they have a camera with them, that they're able to see and be with people in a way that is different without that lens. Can you tell us a little bit more about that time between high school and your amazing Fulbright that you went to when you went to Turkey?
Well, I guess, you know, my mother died when I was 14, and there was a lot of tumult in my family, and I left school. I got a job. I worked in a restaurant, saved money, and with a bunch of friends, we got in an old mail truck turned camper and drove to California from New Jersey, where I grew up. And I started photographing, you know, then. I think, you know, if you're in a place and you're especially interested in culture, as in people, you can't just photograph from a distance and get real images. You really have to engage people. So instead of just walking down a street in a strange place as an observer, you go up and you say hello, you hang out, you maybe spend the day, you maybe come back, you know, the next day or every day for a week or two. And it's such a fabulous way to not only learn about other people, about other ways of living, about the world, but it forms connections. And, you know, one of the most important lessons that I've learned, especially, you know, given my rocky start, was that, you know, all of us can help each other in all kinds of ways all the time. And, you know, even in my work today, I wouldn't be able to produce the stories that I produce without the help of other people. I need to interview people. I need to work with scientists, with experts. They guide me. They share information. And I really think it's important, especially now in such difficult times with the pandemic, we all need to help each other all the time. And that's the world that I really want to live in. And it is the world that I live in every day. And I think that's possible. I think we need to inspire each other, maybe even more than we needed to all along. It's a very, very challenging time.
That's so beautiful and so true. And I think right now people are seeking ways that we can all help each other. But I think what you've been able to do with your work is show these networks of how people are working together to overcome big challenges. Tell us a little bit more about when you were focusing on photography. There's this bridge in your personal timeline between photography and investigative journalism. And what kind of stories were you telling when you were in Mexico? I know that's a really powerful, you expressed a lot of joy about your time in Mexico and Turkey. What did those stories look like?
Well, in Mexico, I photographed in small villages. Again, I was many of my first images that really looked like more than, you know, a postcard, you know, some more complex images, documentary photography. I was photographing in mountain villages. And again, it was the first time I'd traveled outside the country. So there was that kind of, you know, amazing, discovery of other ways of life. I met great people, and it was 4 months. So it was immersion. So that was really great. And I didn't speak the language at all. So, I was really living through my eyes and a lot of pantomime. And then, that began, you know, a lot of travel. There was initially US. I did a lot of travel in the US. And then, when I finally graduated college when I was 25 years old, it took me 8 years to pay my way and work my way through college and with a degree in photography. And I also, had a minor in art history. I did a through Europe trip for 7 months, and I really wanted to step outside the West for a few minutes. So I chose to go to Turkey, and I ended up spending 6 weeks and went all the way to the Iranian border, all the way across the country. And that was so exciting to me. And one of the things that most thrilled me was seeing nomads. And I was also trying to figure out women's roles in that society. And there was just so much that was so different. I was very respectful, long sleeves, covered my head. And I really, you know, just tried to move my way, you know, through that country. I ended up going back for another couple of weeks. And then I applied for a Fulbright and lived there for a year. That year, just before I left, my son was born. So he was 2.5 months old when I took him to Turkey. So I had the really interesting experience of being in Turkey with just my husband. At times I was there alone. And then I was there with my husband and baby. And in each of those situations, I was treated quite differently. But being there with an infant, you know, the world opened. Turks really love babies, and my son was the little sultan that year. And so I spent a lot of time in women's homes with women in a way that a male photographer never could. So a lot of what I was doing there was looking at women, you know, in that culture, and also kind of the modernization of traditional culture. Spent a lot of time with nomads. It was immersive and fascinating and, you know, one of the richest years of my life. And then, you know, from there, I guess that's when I returned to the US, I started doing, you know, a lot of different magazine work. And that's when I ended up doing some science stories and being reminded of my, you know, deep love of the natural world. And that's how all that migrated. And I studied, science and environment, you know, in grad school along with my journalism degree. And most of my work since has focused on wildlife and ecosystems, although I also do look at other environmental issues, pollution, environmental health issues, et cetera, because they all weave together.
It's so beautiful. I can hear that people are central to your work, especially in your early photography days of immersing in communities and being a part and truly, truly trying to understand, trying to immerse and connect with people and see the world through their lens. And I'm really interested in how that transition from your photography and kind of community-centric work into this, as you said, broader picture of investigative journalism that impacts ecosystem and environments, which also still impacts people. But the lens in which you really focused on, I'm so curious, and I won't give away for the audience what I've read all of your articles in National Geographic, but I won't give away for them what your latest work in the wildlife trade has been.
Well, you know, I think in every step, you know, in our lives, one thing builds upon another. And in science, there's communities as well. You know, I've integrated into science communities. I have a lot of contacts, a lot of friends, a lot of colleagues that, you know, share story ideas, share information. You know, it too is its own world. It's a different world than the kind of cultural work I was doing. So, you know, early on it was, you know, wildlife ecosystems, but more and more wildlife trafficking and environmental crime has become, you know, a much more serious issue over, say, the last 15 years. You know, around the 2007 or so, it's when the headlines started appearing about, you know, the horrible scale of elephant poaching in Africa, as well as rhino poaching. And if you are going to be writing about iconic species, wildlife crime became central. It was one of the large threats facing wildlife, along with habitat loss and conflict with human beings. Right. So I started, you know, including that in the work that I was doing. In 2014, I published a book that was co-authored with photographer Steve Winter. He'd spent 10 years photographing tigers across their range, and it was called Tigers Forever, Saving the World's Most Endangered Big Cat. Still in print, still sells. After we published that book, I was approached by a woman named Sybil Foxcroft, who said she had the beginnings of evidence that she said would prove that a tiger tourism venue in Thailand was also trafficking those tigers into the illegal Asian wildlife trade to China. So that became a year-long investigation into a place called the Tiger Temple. It was a Buddhist monastery that doubled as a tiger tourism venue where people went to take selfies with tigers, you know, bottle feed cubs. And we did indeed prove that they were trafficking. Steve Winter worked on that story as well. He went with me to Thailand and shot video. We published that with National Geographic in January 2016. And within 4 months, the government had gotten such intense, you know, pushback from, you know, Thai citizens, from experts, from people around the world, that they went in and confiscated the 178 tigers that lived there and shut it down. And the situation was even far more macabre than we knew. They found 40 tigers frozen in industrial freezers, cubs, in the kitchen, another 20 bottled in large jars, that, you know, those kinds of jars were, you know, confiscated in Vietnam and other places. So, you know, this was all trade. So that was my inadvertent introduction to investigative journalism. I was not trained to do that. It happened by accident. And, you know, you'd talked about my work now, so I'll bring it forward. Because of that work, I was made aware that there are tiger cub petting venues across the United States, and that there were somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 tigers in captivity in the U.S. So, you know, my first question, you know, after the Tiger Temple was, what happens to those cubs when they hit 16 weeks old and they're too big and dangerous to pet and they're no longer, you know, huge moneymakers? And they are huge moneymakers. I mean, that one cub, depending on, you know, the venue and what they charge, one cub can bring in $1 million from the time, you know, it starts to be passed around just after its eyes are open until it hits 16 weeks. But again, once they're too big to pet, they become nothing but a liability. So Steve Winter and I got a grant from National Geographic Society to begin that investigation. It was then assigned as a magazine story. We spent 2 years looking into that, 18 months of which was undercover. And we discovered widespread abuse, widespread wildlife trafficking, and a host of other criminal acts, including, you know, cash sale of, you know, tigers across borders, across state lines, which is illegal. They're an endangered species. It's also a cash business, so it's tax evasion. You know, many, many of these roadside zoos they're not accredited. They have gotten themselves nonprofit status, even though they are for-profit businesses. We also discovered that many, many of the people that own or work at these venues are convicted criminals, many of them felons. I'll lastly note that one of the places that we spent a great deal of time at in Oklahoma was Joe Exotic's, you know, Wynnewood Zoo. And, you know, he was arrested in the middle of that investigation, and I attended the trial and the sentencing as well.
Wow. Sharon, as someone who has watched that whole series and read all your articles, my biggest question is just, how do you summon the courage to continue to go back? Like you said, you were undercover. What does that look like? Like I'm scared listening to your story, because I'm just knowing how much money that people are making each day for each cub. Like there's a lot on the line. It feels like a high stakes investigation. And I'm just, where do you summon the courage to keep going back and keep pressing on the story until you've uncovered everything you can?
Well, I think when you're enmeshed in a story, you're enmeshed in a story. So, you know, you're always, you know, digging in, talking to people, you know, going where you need to go, trying to, you know, get information from anyone and everyone, from, you know, people who work at these venues to government officials. It's not really about summoning courage. You know, I think you're just, you know, following the thread of your work until the story's due. It's not like you ever decide that you're done with any of this kind of work. I could have continued this investigation probably for another 5 years. So I must admit, there were times that I was either seriously depressed by the level of animal abuse I saw, horrible small cages, skinny or obese or scarred or, you know, inappropriately housed, you know, animals, open sores, you know, obvious signs of inbreeding, you know, crossed eyes, spines that almost look like camel spines with a big hump in the middle, all that's inbreeding, right? So just different levels of, you know, poor care, inbreeding, abuse that was really upsetting. I mean, at the worst of those places, I would go back to whatever a tiny little rural motel room was and literally put my head in my hands. And I think I got to go to sleep. You know, just I'm done. There were times that I was scared. I mean, anybody who saw Tiger King, I mean, that was really whitewashed in terms of the intensity of many of the people working in that business. I have all kinds of files from, you know, I have 1,000 files from Joe Exotic's cell phone, for example, texts, photographs. I have, recordings, a lot of information from a lot of people, and there's a lot of horror, and many of those people are very, very dangerous people. I mean, people with, aggravated assault charges, gun charges, drug charges. There were times I was really nervous because, it might sound weird to say this, but when it comes to investigative reporting, I don't know what I'm doing. I wasn't trained for this. I fell into this. And, I just kind of make my way. And I think the reason that I'm successful is because when I'm committed to something, I'm relentless. I'm a very serious researcher. But it's not like I know what I'm doing. And if there's panic moments, that's what it is. It's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I think there was one other thing that we wanted to talk about, and that was pushing boundaries. Did you want to hear something about that?
Yes. Yeah, please. You said you described yourself as relentless. In this podcast, we talk about resilience. And I think being relentless in your work or in whatever drives you is part of this resilience. Like when I ask you questions about being courageous, it's because I feel like your stories are scary. I feel like it would be easy for some people to stop in the face of some of the danger or horror that you've seen. Feeling of being relentless.
Well, again, so much of who we are goes back to our childhoods, right? I mean, I had a challenging childhood. I mean, to be out on your own when you're 16, it's way too young to be out on your own. I didn't know it then, but it is. And I think if you have to, overcome challenges early on, it teaches you to do that without being dramatic about it, right? I mean, there's challenges, you address them. But the other thing is, I feel like unless I'm pushing the boundaries a little bit, I'm not moving towards whatever my potential might be. And again, early on, there was a lot of obstacles. Like when I got an equivalency diploma and started college, and I felt like the stupidest person in the room. I didn't know how to write a term paper. I didn't go to high school. I didn't learn how to do that. There always had to be some kind of like dealing with challenges. And from photography, I went to writing. I'd always written, but it was like journal but I'd always been a writer. There was a real choice in college whether I was going to be a writer or a photographer. I guess the answer was both. I still do photograph as well. And Steve Winter and I, who I keep mentioning, not only because he's been my partner in many work projects, but he's also my life partner. So, life and work. So when we do multimedia pieces together, I do the audio, he shoots the video, we both co-produce. I've really enjoyed learning new things. Learning to do multimedia, figuring out how to write, learning how to do public lectures, learning how to do investigative work. And a couple of years ago, I began an affiliation with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington as a public policy fellow focusing on wildlife crime. So I spent a year and a half in residence with some of the smartest people I've ever had the phenomenal opportunity to spend time with. And I learned a lot about how public policy influences every aspect of life. I remain affiliated as a global fellow, although I'm not physically there anymore. Although I guess no one is, given COVID. And I think pushing boundaries is really important for all of us. And again, that circles back around to community. The only way I think we can achieve what we dream of is by reaching out to and working with people that we admire, people that are further down the road, people that we can collaborate with. And the one last thing I want to say about that is that I've always wanted to reach out to, you know, people in their teens, people in their early 20s that feel that they don't have opportunity. Because if you do have a dream, it doesn't matter where you're starting. You know, if you take one step at a time and move towards that dream, and again, reach out to the people that can help you along the way, you know, you can achieve those dreams. It was not easy for me to be stepping out in the world as a 16-year-old. And I loved photography. And it created a life for me.
It's so powerful to hear you give these messages of moving forward, pushing boundaries, asking for help. I feel like asking for help is a really common theme amongst the explorers that I talk to. At some point in their timeline of getting to where they are now, there was someone that they had to ask for support, for help. And early on, you talked about your grandfather investing in you and giving you items. And then that person, this mysterious person who gave you that 35mm camera that launched the rest of your photography, early photography career. But where does it come from? Like, is there a time in your life you can remember when you asked for help and you knew that, like, this is the pathway of how we move forward? It's like you ask for help, you ask for support.
Well, I think, you know, there's probably many small moments along the way. I mean, I think, you know, for me, a lot of it was serendipity. Somebody owed me money, and I had been interested in photography. That person had a darkroom and had shown, you know, taken me in the darkroom and, you know, showed me, you know, their work. And they had a camera, and it was like, well, I can't pay you. Do you want this? So that happened. And then a friend of mine who was a couple of years older was going to Ramapo College, a state college in New Jersey that had a fabulous photo program. And he said, hey, you want to come sit in on classes with me? And, you know, I was scared of the idea of college. And I spent a day sitting in on classes that were fascinating. So then I went to college. And the professor there, David Freund, was fascinating and amazing and encouraged me. And so, you know, then that happened. Later on, he recommended me for an internship at Magnum Photos in New York, which, you know, was a photographer's collective with some of the most amazing photographers in the world, Cartier-Bresson, you know, Bruce Davidson, Kudelka. I mean, amazing, amazing photographers. And I ended up working there off and on part-time for 2.5 years, looking at Cartier-Bresson's contact sheets at lunchtime. So, you know, it's just like along the way, we meet people, and sometimes it's, you know, the way we move forward is a result of our own, you know, hard work and dedication. But sometimes it's just being out there and being interested and taking those steps, and then, you know, serendipity happens. So, you know, I think asking for help is really important. Being open to help is really important. Taking advantage of opportunities that come along, not in a bad way, not in terms of taking advantage of in a bad way, but embracing opportunity and having the courage to do things that scare us. You know, it can open whole worlds.
There is a time in your story that you've mentioned today about, it almost seems like not knowing the next step has been a gift for you. Like, you just seem to move forward with excitement and an open mind, that you're open to the possibilities of what's next. And there's so many points in your story that, again, to me seems so scary. And you're so open to whatever is out there. And you embrace life with this adventure spirit of, like, we are going to make it work. It's going to happen. Even when it comes to having bringing your child with you in the field and having your person there. I mean, I'm just trying to remember to drink water every day. And you took your son to Costa Rica. I think it's super inspiring me to hear these smaller steps of the doors that opened and the opportunities that you accepted or sought out that helped you get to each little level.
Well, there always are new adventures around the corner. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, I was able to move forward with this amazing life and this amazing career I've been lucky enough to have. I mean, I've lost track, but I've traveled to a lot of countries around the world. I don't know, 40, 50, I have no idea. My son and I were talking this morning, and we counted that I think he'd been to 22 countries by the time he got out of college traveling with us. So again, I had one child, a son named Nick Ruggia, his name is. I was divorced when he was three, so I was a single parent for part of that time, and you know, Steve is now, you know, his stepdad. So, you know, a lot of challenges there, no doubt, but being out in the world and discovering like Costa Rican rainforests, you know, with my six-year-old who I was seeing, you know, toucans and parrots and poison dart frogs and, you know, all of the amazingness that is the tropical jungles for the first time with my six-year-old who's also seeing it at the first time, first time, you know, snorkeling, you know, in Central America, you know, with my then 8-year-old, again, discovering all that together. It was fabulous. You know, yes, many of these things can be hard, but, you know, if you approach these challenges, I think, in a methodical way, and don't, you know, overcomplicate them. It's possible. I mean, taking a 2.5-month-old baby to Turkey certainly freaked out my relatives. They were convinced that I was, you know, that was it. You know, baby was going to die in Turkey. And at that time, the only thing anybody knew about Turkey was a movie called Midnight Express that was a Turkish jail movie. Fairly brutal. But meanwhile, you know, I got a collapsible, play pen thing that was the baby's bed and brought some clothes. They have baby clothes in Turkey, and a stroller that laid down into a bed in case I was moving around and, you know, dealt with it. And it was fabulous. And, you know, what a gift for my son as well. You know, I had the baby in a front pack. He was out and about with his parents all the time. Again, what a gift, spending your entire first year with that kind of attention. And I just had to have my camera on my shoulder, not around my neck, because, you know, baby still had a soft spot. I couldn't bang him in the head with the camera. It was like really that simple. I don't know. It's all challenging. Life is challenging. Life is hard. Life, you know, but so much is about attitude. Are we going to, you know, embrace the challenges, find the joy, feed our curiosity, you know, or are we not? I mean, it is our one and precious life.
I see that Mary Oliver quote in there. I know that one in this, you know, what will you do with this one precious life? Are there any strategies you would recommend for growing what you call your relentless spirit? And what I call this, you know, these characteristics of resilience. You are driven, you are open-minded, you are open to possibilities, you seek out adventure, but you also continue to seek the story until it is truly done. In fact, I love that you say you would continue to keep seeking if time and maybe money would let you. So what strategies would you recommend for someone also trying to grow their relentless spirit?
You know, I think in general, be brave. You know, I think many of us, and especially women, are often limited by a sense of unworthiness. We don't feel like we know enough. We don't feel like we're accomplished enough to do X, or to call this person, or to try to get into this program, or, you know, try to study with, you know, this person. You know, there's a lot of ways we can limit ourselves with our thinking because we don't feel like we're good enough. You know, we're all on a path. And if you look at life as a journey, we're all moving our way along. And there's always a next step. And just, you know, just do it. Nike. Just do it. Whether you think you're going to, you know, win what you're after or not. You know, I was 27 years old when I applied for that Fulbright. I had a bachelor's degree, but, you know, I'd published a bit in some magazines, but I didn't have some huge, fabulous, you know, influential career at that time, you know, but they saw I was really serious. I'd already been to Turkey twice. I had work to show. I did my homework. I produced a good proposal. I had, you know, people whom I respected, who were kind enough to give me letters of recommendation. And I applied and I was lucky enough to get it. But, you know, I think a really important thing to remember is that when you're rejected from something that you really want, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not good enough, or that you're not talented, or that you shouldn't continue to pursue what you're after. Here's a great example I love to share with people. That same year I applied for the Fulbright, I applied for a New Jersey State Council on the Arts Fellowship in Photography. It was the third year in a row I'd applied. First 2 years I'd been rejected. Grants were $1,000. For, you know, a lot of people got $1,000. And then there was like three grants that were like $3,000. I was pregnant. I was doing black and white work, and I couldn't go in the dark room, you know, with any conscience, working with glacial acetic acid and other toxic chemicals. So I resubmitted the same portfolio that I'd sent in the year before, just because I didn't want to not submit. So, oh well, I just sent that in. I found out on the day my son was born that I'd gotten the grant, and they'd upped the grants to $3,000 and $8,000. And what wasn't worth $1,000 the year before got me $8,000 a year later. You know, committees, grant committees, acceptance committees, they're human beings, and everyone has their own interests and their own prejudices and their own inclinations and their own relationships with people. Again, I think that's just a perfect example of, you know, keep trying. And again, it, you know, not getting something that you're trying for isn't necessarily an indictment of you or your work.
That is such a great story. I'm going to remember that and tell myself that every time I apply for something. I didn't even consider that or think about how the darkroom chemicals would impact you're the baby. Like, I'm so far removed from the actual physical process of photos. There's so much I don't know about that. And I love that story that you resubmitted and you got even more money than you thought. Ugh, Sharon, that's what I needed today. And I think a lot of other people are going to need that story too, as another reminder to keep going and to separate yourself from your work, from your self-worth, from, you know, your next opportunity. The last question I have for you is, what's next? What are you, were so driven. You were a person who never stops working and thinking and tinkering with your next big idea. So what's next for you?
Well, this is a period that for many of us is really about trying to figure out what life is under COVID. Right? I mean, chapter one with the pandemic was fear, panic, all of that. You know, I live in the New York metropolitan area. We got hit hard early on before we even really knew what this virus was. And I've been researching zoonotic diseases since 2005, so I know way too much. And I was really, really anxious and scared. And it's not like I'm at all unconcerned at this point. We maintain very high safety protocols. We do not want to get this very dangerous virus. And it's spreading like wildfire across the U.S., still not contained. So, you know, we don't know what this is going to be. Obviously, we're not traveling. It's, you know, Steve is a photographer, you know, travels internationally. He's supposed to be in India working on a story now, and that's not happening. I'm not traveling for work. I'm working on smaller stories. I have an idea or two for some stories that could possibly be done in the U.S. that perhaps, you know, drive there, maybe live in an RV. You know, again, they're in the wild. So I think I'm trying to strategize what can be done amidst the pandemic, you know, safely. And I also have another application in for a fellowship that would give me the opportunity to do some really exciting investigative work into, you know, environmental issues in three countries. I'll find out about that at the end of the month, fingers crossed. But again, even if that does not pan out, there's other grants, there's other support, there's publications that will be interested in the stories that I'd like to produce. So this, I do have a project, you know, in the works that I'm committed to. And once I get funding and support, I'll be moving forward with that. I also do freelance editing for a really wonderful publication called The Conservation, The Conversation. And again, just trying to maintain sanity and be active and positive in a very confusing world. And anyone I know who is thinking and aware of the dual threats of pandemic and climate change, goes through periods of you know, serious anxiety. I think, you know, we really have to keep moving forward towards a better world and try to figure out ways to emerge from this pandemic crisis that build a better world for all of us, both ecologically, economically, in terms of, you know, equality, racial and economic equality. I mean, we really have some challenges ahead of us. And I'm really hoping that, you know, from the ashes of this serious crisis, you know, a phoenix rises that is a better world.
Thank you so much for sharing with us today. I know myself and all of our listeners will want to embody your relentless spirit in trying to make this a better world. So again, thank you so much for taking time to share your stories. And is there any last words, any final things you'd like to share out?
It's so funny. I'm so uncomfortable with flattery. I just feel like, you know, I live my life one step at a time and just continue to try to learn and grow throughout it all. And I'm grateful for the help I receive, and it feels good to help others. And I just hope that amidst all the divisiveness that kind of is certainly the U.S. right now, and amidst all the conflict, we can remember that there's a lot of amazing people who really care and really want to do good things in the world. And you know, keep moving forward, keep reaching out, keep connecting. You know, we truly can make this a better world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to include me. in your amazing, amazing series. Thank you for the work you do, Pig.
Friends, this concludes season one of Thriving on the Possibility. Stay tuned for what happens next as we reimagine for season two. The intro to this podcast was recorded by Jay at National Geographic headquarters in June of 2019. I created all of the music using Apple Loops, and I recorded and edited this conversation. The logo for Thriving on the Possibility was created by Jen Levrault.